This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. This program is originating in Washington. This is the Voice of America. We'll return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
Mystery still surrounds the flight of Luna 15, the latest Soviet space probe. Sir Bernard Lovell, director of the Jodrell Bank Observatory, says the station is still in contact with the Soviet vehicle, but has no information regarding its intended mission. The Luna 15 is now in a low orbit around the moon, moving at times within 16 kilometers of its surface. Dr. Lovell suggested that the unmanned Soviet space vehicle may be trying to photograph the Americans on the moon. Egyptian and Israeli fighter planes attacked each other's ground positions across the Suez Canal yesterday for the first time since the 1967 war. Egypt said it knocked down 19 Israeli jets. Israel admitted losing 2 planes and said it shot down 5 Egyptian aircraft. The battle was touched off by an Israeli commando raid earlier across the canal on an Egyptian fortress. Israel said it held the fort for an hour, but Egypt said it repulsed the Israelis. Casualty reports conflict. Both sides see the fighting as a serious escalation. Reuters news agency quotes Israeli officials in Tel Aviv as saying the ceasefire between Israel and Egypt has become fiction. Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Iban met in Jerusalem yesterday with United States Ambassador to Israel Walworth Barber. An Israeli official said Mr. Iban gave the ambassador his government's reaction to the recent Middle East talks in Moscow between Soviet officials and American Assistant Secretary of State Joseph Sisko. Israel has opposed the talks. The Council of the Organization of American States met in informal, secret sessions early today in Washington. It meets again later today to consider reports from an OAS commission that is trying to enforce a ceasefire between El Salvador and Honduras. El Salvador has insisted that its troops will not leave Honduras until there are satisfactory guarantees for its people in Honduras. El Salvador also has accused Honduras of violating the OAS ceasefire that began Friday night. Honduras has denied the charge. The entire cabinet of South Vietnam's Premier Tran Van Hung submitted its resignation. With that story, here is VOA correspondent Wayne Hyde in Saigon.
A government spokesman said the prime minister held a special session of the cabinet Monday morning at 10:30 Saigon time and accepted the resignations of all the ministers. The reason for the resignation, said the spokesman, was to facilitate the setting up of a new administration by Prime Minister Hung. The cabinet members will stay on in the form of a caretaker government until new members are chosen. The spokesman would make no other comment on the subject. Wayne Hyde, Voice of America, Saigon.
American air attacks continue against Viet Cong staging areas north of Thai Ninh. The province, which always has been considered a sanctuary of the North Vietnamese forces, is north of Saigon along the Cambodian border. Allied ground forces moved into a bombed sector Sunday with a 4,000-man armored brigade to survey the damage done to the communist camps by American air attacks. Elsewhere in Vietnam, the lull in fighting continues. A veteran United States Foreign Service officer, Lloyd Rivas, has been appointed chargé d'affaires ad interim in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Mr. Rivas' past experience includes assignments in Hanoi before the communist takeover and in neighboring Laos. Cambodia previously had named Thay Sok as its representative in Washington. The United States and Cambodia agreed 2 weeks ago to reestablish diplomatic relations which were broken by Cambodia in 1965. 15,000 persons in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, attended the funeral of civil rights leader Samuel Devenny. Mr. Devenny, a Roman Catholic campaigner, died Thursday following a heart attack. The 64-year-old Irish leader suffered an earlier heart attack last May after police arrested him in his home. Northern Ireland's Catholic minority has staged protest actions since last fall against what it terms discrimination by the country's Protestant majority. The United States Senate will resume debate Tuesday on the controversial anti-ballistic missile proposal. The final week of debate will begin with the Senate still divided on the Nixon administration proposal to deploy the defensive system designed to protect missile bases located in the United States. Democratic Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, the leader of the opposition forces, maintains that the vote will be extremely close, with the outcome in doubt until the final vote. Supporters of the system, called Safeguard, say it is necessary to protect America's missile force in the 1970s. And America's air traffic controllers reportedly are preparing resignations in sufficient numbers to bring about a massive tie-up of air traffic at the nation's airports after Apollo 11 splashes down. Spokesmen for the controllers' union say at least one half of the union's more than 7,000 members have indicated they will resign over a federal aviation agency threat. They predict it will disrupt domestic and international flights. That's the news from the Voice of America. Kay Gallant reporting.
The Voice of America has a limited supply of color photographs of the three Apollo 11 astronauts. If you would like one of these souvenir photos, write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible. This is The Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. In about 7 hours, the world's first moon explorers, astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, will attempt to leave the lunar surface and return to the orbiting Apollo 11 command ship. They have been on the lunar surface some 14 hours and 50 minutes. At this hour, Flight Commander Armstrong and Astronaut Aldrin are in a 7-hour sleep period in the cabin of the lunar landing vehicle. Astronaut Michael Collins is reported sound asleep in the command ship as it orbits the moon for the 21st time. But now let's go to Houston and Jim Miller for a late status report.
Well, right now, the two astronauts and the LEM are, as we know, sitting on the lunar surface, asleep. The telemetry monitored here on Earth leads the physicians and surgeons to believe that Armstrong, while resting, is not asleep. And they only have about 3 hours to go because they're due to get up along about 3 1/2 hours from now, actually. Meanwhile, the Columbia spacecraft continues to orbit the moon. Collins, the pilot of the Columbia, is sound asleep, according to all indications here in Houston. After the wake-up this morning, which will come at 9:42 Central Time, which is local Houston time, which would be 5 hours later than that, which would be 14 hours and 42 minutes Greenwich time, they'll have a 2-hour checkout of the spacecraft, the lunar module sitting on the moon's surface, and then they will fire up the rocket engine and begin their ascent at 12:55 Houston time, which would be 17:55 Greenwich time later this afternoon, and go on up, prepare for their redocking with Columbia later in the day, and then at shortly after 11 o'clock Central Daylight Time, which again converting into Greenwich time would be about 4 hours Greenwich time, on Tuesday, they would begin to prepare to come back. That would be the initiating maneuver to trans-Earth injection and the long 3-day trip back. That's the situation here in Houston as we are now 117 hours and 37 minutes since these three men blasted off from Cape Kennedy, Florida, last Wednesday. And now back to you in Washington, Norm.
We'll be returning to you, Jim Miller, later on in the program. Merle Wall, we were talking about the EVA activity. I don't think that we've brought out the fact in the last hour or so that this mission really doesn't end with splashdown this time, as have the other missions. There's about 21 days till we actually have a termination point for this. Is that right?
That's right. I would say that none of the missions really end with splashdown, Norm, because there's all the post-flight work where they're evaluating the systems and trying to decide whether any changes have to be made for the succeeding missions. But in this case, we have this very special quarantine period set up with elaborate preparations and precautions to make sure that there is no contamination of the Earth by anything that's brought back from the moon.
Now, this process will start as soon as they leave the moon, I assume. And it will continue. They'll be filtering, will they not, in canisters in the command module, any lunar dust that might have been transferred?
Well, as you said before, Norm, the quarantine preparations and so forth have already started, and I believe there's a apparently a countdown from the time they deposited some of the extra gear they weren't going to bring back out on the lunar surface. But the filtering of the spacecraft atmosphere is a continuous process, and it turns out that the basic filtering equipment that was built into the spacecraft is perfectly capable of removing any of the type of contamination that we would expect to bring back from the moon. But anyway, this equipment is continuously filtering the atmosphere, any other dust stirred up by the astronauts as they prepare for takeoff from the lunar surface and so forth. And by the time they transfer to the command module, certainly their atmosphere will be fairly pure. Plus, they will have had a chance to shake out the dust of the moon pretty completely by that time.
I understand that while they're still attached, that the pressure in the command module will be slightly higher than in the lunar module, so that no dust particles can enter the command module. Is that right?
Right, that is
the
plan.
The way they control right. That, I think. And then, of course, they will don special garments at splashdown and then be placed aboard the carrier and proceed directly to the mobile quarantine facility, I believe.
That's correct. And they will be, or the mobile quarantine facility, of course, is on the carrier.
Yes. Looks somewhat like a mobile home.
Right.
Many of our listeners are
campers, a
house trailer without wheels. However, a much more sophisticated device, I should say.
Well, the cabin is, of course, completely closed with its own life support provisions. It's sealed so that it cannot put out any moon particles into the Earth's atmosphere, at least until we've had a chance to evaluate them and find out whether there's anything hazardous about these particles.
I think it's Dr. Carpentier and a recovery engineer by the name of John Hirasaki that will be in the quarantine lounge, and we'll proceed all the way back to the lunar receiving lab.
I think before the quarantine period is over, why, there's going to be a lot of people in the quarantine with everybody else, because it turns out that anybody that's finds it necessary to come in contact with the astronauts or with any of the lunar material will be required to stay within the quarantine until the critical period is up. So There are provisions down there in the lunar receiving laboratory for quite a few people.
There'll be many facets to discuss regarding the quarantine as the program proceeds and the mission proceeds. You know, reaction continues to come in here at home and from around the world. For a brief summary of reaction to Apollo 11 in Southeast Asia, here is VOA correspondent Roy Heineke.
Astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin barely had time to get back into their spacecraft before reaction to the moonwalk began in Southeast Asia. In Malaysia, the nation's king and prime minister, both of whom followed the moon landing and the historic walk by shortwave radio, cabled congratulatory messages to President Nixon and the American people. The king of Malaysia, in his message, stressed the hope that the achievements of the U.S. space program will serve as a reminder to the nations of the world that peace and goodwill are essential to further exploration of space. He told President Nixon that he was praying for the safe return of the three astronauts who, as he described it, were risking their lives for science. Prime Minister Tunku Abdulrahman, in a separate statement, said that the praiseworthy efforts gained by American scientists from the courage of the three astronauts has won the admiration of the world. Also in Kuala Lumpur, the capital of Malaysia, the Malay language newspaper Berita Harian called the moonwalk of the two astronauts a victory for all mankind. And it is hoped, it said, it will bring the maximum benefit to future generations. In Thailand, the newspaper Bangkok World noted that Monday's space adventure of astronauts Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins infected a great part of the world. And the paper's editorial added, it is safe to say that never in the history of mankind has so large a portion of the world's population been so emotionally involved in a single event. The proof positive of the benefits of a free society, the editorial continued, are not underlined simply by the technological achievement of the U.S. space program, but in coordination with the freedom of expression combined to show that national intention must be joined by national openness. In considering the philosophy behind the American effort, the editorial concluded, it seems fair to assume that the world as a whole will participate in the benefits of this new approach to the mysterious. Roy Heineke, Voice of America, East Asian Bureau.
President Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines hailed the achievements of the Apollo 11 astronauts earlier today, and VOA's Jim Alves had the details.
In a message soon after astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin completed the moon exploration, President Marcos said the Filipino people joined the world in congratulating the United States for putting the first men on the moon. President Marcos called the moonwalk a triumphant milestone in the conquest of space, which augurs a greater achievement in the broadening of man's vision. He added, the feat furthers the fulfillment of a larger destiny within the framework of a true human brotherhood and an enduring peace. The lunar exploration occurred noontime Monday in the Philippines and was broadcast by several television and radio networks. The broadcast was relayed to the Philippines via satellite. In Manila, huge crowds gathered in several public places where television networks and appliance companies have placed large screen television sets. Pedestrian traffic was halted for several hours in an underpass in Manila's central commercial district as people watched the telecast on television sets in display windows. One appliance store was stormed by an angry crowd when it turned off its set. The store owner was forced to turn it on again. The crowds broke into an applause as the two Apollo 11 astronauts planted the American flag on the moon. Major Philippine newspapers came out with extra editions Monday afternoon headlining the moonwalk. This is Jim Alves, Voice of America, Manila.
The people of the United States followed closely the progress of their Apollo 11 astronauts, and VOA's Edwin Gordon spoke to several Americans about their reactions to the spectacle of man upon the moon.
This is Los Angeles, the third largest city in the United States. Today, the second day in the era of the moon, it could be any large city in any country. The immediate tension may have disappeared, but the excitement remains as the citizens of this Pacific Coast metropolis begin to reflect and evaluate the feat of the astronauts. What the moon landing means, how it will affect the individual, and when you get right down to it, was it worth it? We put these questions to a cross-section of the Los Angeles community, to a Japanese-American real estate salesman.
I think it certainly was worth it. It just proves the technological advancement of our age and certainly something that we never expected to see achieved during our lifetime anyway. Well, I can look forward to more advanced everyday living, probably more advanced mode of transportation, food, recreation. I think everything, you know. It's just the whole concept is amazing. There's no end to what the human mind can achieve.
Still, there were the dissenters. Some thought man's domain is Earth and the problems on this single planet. A Negro radio and television repairman.
I think that there's too much suffering going on down here that that money could have been spent to alleviate. And instead they chose to invest all of this money in a space project. And you take like the people in Biafra, and as well as people in this country who are starving.
The impact, though, will be the greatest on the very young, although they may not yet realize it. This 8-year-old was born in the year President Kennedy called for conquest of the moon in this decade. He watched the television broadcast of the lunar landing, bringing to it his already developing knowledge of space science.
I was expecting it to be kind of hot where it's real light and they might find good rocks. If we hope enough, they might find even gold.
Well, maybe not gold, but Neil Armstrong, Edwin Aldrin, and Michael Collins will be bringing back something precious. And another 8-year-old, another moon child, is very much aware of it.
They went to such a risk for the whole world, and it's really worth it.
And that's the cross-section of reaction from the people of Los Angeles on America's Pacific Coast. Edwin Gordon, VOA, Los Angeles.
There's more reaction from Europe to the moonwalk of the Apollo 11 crew. Bill Winchester has this report from Bonn, where he says people have braved the early dawn hours to watch the event on television.
Television pictures beamed here by satellite were extraordinarily sharp, and it's believed an unprecedented number of Germans viewed the coverage through early Monday morning. Shops reported a record demand for rental television sets. Theaters, cinemas, and operas reported the lowest attendance in memory for a Sunday evening. Police said in many cities, automobile traffic was far below normal volume as Germans by the millions decided to spend this Sunday evening in their own living rooms before their television sets. On the official side, Chancellor Kurt-Georg Kiesinger has sent a congratulatory telegram to President Nixon. I have watched with rapt attention and admiration the flight of Apollo 11 and the historic landing of the first man on the moon, the Chancellor told Mr. Nixon. He added, I express to you, Mr. President, to the three daring astronauts, and to our friends, the American people, my hearty congratulations for this sensational deed, which represents one of the greatest and most memorable events in the history of mankind. These the words of West German Chancellor Kiesinger to President Nixon. The chief press spokesman here in Bonn, Mr. Günther Diehl, expressed congratulations in the name of the federal government, saying the landing signaled a new epoch for mankind, and that the entire German people followed the event with admiration and best wishes for the safe return of the astronauts. Foreign Minister Willy Brandt echoed these words and added, we have followed on our television screens a truly epoch-making event. We congratulate the President and people of the United States and all who contributed to the space trip. But above all, we wish the first moon travelers further success and a safe return to our good Earth. This is Bill Winchester, Voice of America, Bonn.
And this from London, Norman Gelb reporting.
We Queen Elizabeth has sent a message to the United States voicing her admiration for the fortitude of the astronauts who walked on the moon. The Queen offered her good wishes and prayers for their safe return to Earth. London looked a little groggy Monday morning. Many people here stayed up late, some until the dawn's early light, to see on their television sets man taking his first steps on solid ground beyond the Earth's atmosphere. The London Times said Monday morning it was difficult to tell yet the significance of man on the moon, but it said the achievement of the American astronauts will always be one of the wonders of the world. The newspaper The Guardian says no other great adventure was as great as this. The London Daily Mail said whatever happens, we shall not stop now. It is the measure of man's restless spirit, the Daily Mail said, and of his greatness, that he should take on the universe. Norman Gelb reporting from London.
This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. The lunar lander Eagle has been on the lunar surface some 15 hours and 9 minutes as of this moment. Merle Wall, at about 17 hours 55 Greenwich Mean Time, the astronauts will prepare to ascend from the lunar surface. Now, just what does this entail? What do they have to do in preparation for this?
In this case now, the astronauts are going to have to do just about what crews of thousands of people do back on the Earth. They're going to have to prepare a space vehicle for a launch. Of course, they have the assistance of all the ground networks because of the good communications we have with the Earth, but they have to accomplish this preparation for launch and the launch by themselves. And so they'll go through the complete check-off of everything on their list to make sure everything's in readiness, and at the appropriate time, when the command module is in the right position, of course, they will go ahead and ignite their ascent engine and move up into a lunar orbit.
And this is where this very helpful descent stage that took them down served as a work area and focal point for the EVA activity is left behind, is that
and
right?
As a launch platform.
As a launch platform. Very versatile part of the vehicle. And what are some of the considerations in the vertical rise from the lunar surface as far as trajectory is concerned?
Well, right now, of course, they do not have themselves located as precisely as they would like. So there will be some measure of unknown as to what orbit they finally want to get into. But when the time comes, I'm sure they will be able to get within a very nominal range of the command module, and with the help of their radar and other devices will affect a successful rendezvous.
Are you saying this desired arc cannot be projected until they do get a rendezvous radar locking?
That's right. At this time, without being located precisely on the lunar surface, there has to be some measure of error, although, there's always a probability you're right on, even without knowing. And until they get some direct communication between the command module and the LEM, they won't be able to make the final rendezvous determination.
Will part of this vertical rise have to take into consideration some of the terrain features to clear them?
No, I don't think there's that's a problem at all. The first part of their trajectory is straight up, and I'm sure they're above all lunar terrain features that would affect them.
Well, in less than 7 hours, the world's first moon explorers, astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, will attempt to leave the lunar surface and return to the orbiting Apollo 11 command ship. And, of course, we'll broadcast that on the VOA's continuing coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. This program is originating in Washington. This is the Voice of America. We'll return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
The world's first moon explorers, American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, are resting in the cabin of their lunar landing vehicle. Later today, they will attempt the critical link with the Apollo 11 command ship, which is orbiting the moon. In their 2-hour, 40-minute moon walk, the astronauts scooped up lunar rocks and other surface material for later microscopic examination. They also performed a number of scientific experiments. An estimated 500 million persons around the world watched their exploits on live television after hearing Flight Commander Armstrong's first words upon setting foot on the lunar surface. "That's one small step for man, one giant step for mankind." In other world news, Voice of America correspondent Wayne Hyde reports from Saigon that the entire cabinet of Premier Tran Van Hung has resigned to facilitate organization of a new administration. The lull in ground combat continued while American air attacks struck Viet Cong areas near the Cambodian border. General Earl Wheeler, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, warned in Saigon that previous lulls have been followed by intensified communist offensives. Sunday's clash between Egyptian and Israeli forces along the Suez Canal have been termed a very serious escalation by an Egyptian official. The Council of the Organization of American States meets again today in Washington to hear reports about the ceasefire between quarreling Central American neighbors, Honduras and El Salvador. Italian Premier-designate Mariano Rumor continues his search for a coalition cabinet to replace his center-left coalition that fell 2 weeks ago. America's air controllers reportedly are planning a walkout that would cause massive delays at airports throughout the country. And Brazil has clinched a spot in the Davis Cup tennis interzone finals against Britain, scheduled for later this month at Wimbledon. Brazil took an unbeatable 3-0 lead over Mexico, while the British edged South Africa 3-2. That's the news from the Voice of America. Kay Gallant reporting.
You're listening to the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. Lunar landing craft Eagle has been on the lunar surface, the Sea of Tranquility, 15 hours and 60 minutes. Let's go to Houston and a status report from VOA's Jim Miller.
Just a few minutes ago, Mission Control made its latest announcement on the status of both Columbia and its 22nd revolution around the moon, where Mike Collins is sound asleep and sleeping well, according to all of the information received here in Houston. And they also say that all is going well at Tranquility Base, although Neil Armstrong apparently is dozing and not sleeping too well. It is not causing any concern, however, as far as Buzz Aldrin is concerned. They're not sure because he, of course, is not instrumented and they can't tell that much about it. They have now just about 3 hours to go, more of sleep. Norm, I had a question from Earl Waugh. Concerning the TV camera, apparently it has been left on the lunar surface, and I wondered what its fate would be or if it would have any role if it is to be left there.
No, the camera, of course, operates with systems that are in the landing stage, I guess, but I don't believe there are any plans to activate it further or anything like that. Not that I know of, anyway.
Merlin, watching Buzz Aldrin move about and listening to his comments on television, he commented about moving from light to shadow on the moon as being quite different from the same sort of action on Earth, and that it seemed to be more abrupt and more difficult for him to adjust his eyes as he moved. Why would this be? Is it much more critical and sharply contrasted there between the light and the dark?
Yes, I'm not sure exactly that we can't find situations here on Earth where the light contrast isn't as bad. For example, on some of the white sandy beaches in Florida and places like that, you could have situations where you go from very dark to very bright. But the fact that the lunar surface is apparently a very light surface dust makes it very, very blinding. And then in the shadow, it's just very dark. So I just say there was a high light contrast. The other remark he made was about the the temperature out of the shadow is supposed to be up around 250 degrees, and then in the shadow is well below zero. So apparently there wasn't as much of a contrast with regard to the temperature that they expected. They would feel this primarily through their visors and so forth, because they're so well insulated otherwise. But I would say we could probably find situations where the light contrast is almost as bad, but I'm pretty sure it's uniformly severe up there.
The officials here in Houston were quite pleased with the lunar surface activity and with the manner in which the astronauts were able to move about. Obviously, it was much, much different than walking on Earth. And the moon suit, of course, or the portable life support system, as it is called, seemed to function quite well. I was wondering how they could really simulate conditions to test that suit before they finally had to use it under actual conditions on the moon.
Well, there are several simulators set up whereby you can approximate 1/6 G that the astronauts were trained in. Of course, when they were working at full Earth gravity, they had to carry the full loads of this equipment, and so in contrast, when they get in a 1/6 G environment, the tasks would immediately seem relatively less. It looked like they had plenty of control over their bodily motions and everything else. The one constant that you can't vary, of course, is your inertia, and they quickly learned to adjust to the fact that the inertia was still there, even though the forces were lower.
Someone watching on the television here commented at the time that in adjusting to this moon gravity of 1/6 of Earth's, what would happen if, upon making contact with the lunar surface and failing immediately to adjust to that gravity, one of the astronauts had fallen and become prone on the lunar surface? Would he have been able to have get himself upright, or would he have required assistance from the other astronaut?
Well, I've seen fully suited men finally get themselves up with full Earth gravity, and I believe that they probably would have been able to get up by themselves. But having the buddy system there, I'm sure that in that event, the other one would have been there quickly to help out if such an event had occurred.
All right, and we'll take it back to you, Norm, in Washington.
This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11, and national worldwide reaction to Apollo 11 continues to pour in. For example, correspondent Robert Chancellor has weighed in with this report from Australia, where much of the relay work for NASA's Apollo 11 venture is done.
Australia had a front row seat for Monday's historic moon telecast and seemed to enjoy every minute of it. Prime Minister John Gorton led his nation in watching the spectacle. He drove to the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station in the mountains near the capital of Canberra following the successful moon landing. After a tour of the electronics-packed structure, Mr. Gorton told newsmen he had been blinded by science, explaining that he had asked the Australian technicians on duty what the various knobs and dials and squiggly green lines were for, that he had been told and couldn't begin to pretend to understand. Prime Minister Gorton also issued a formal statement at that time, calling the landing of men on the moon a peaceful triumph for all mankind. It is a success that excites the wonder and admiration of all. Australia is proud to have played a part, he added, through its tracking station and the park's radio telescope, which provided the television pictures of the extravehicular activity or moonwalk. Mr. Gorton thanked the astronauts, wished them Godspeed and a safe return. Later in the day, the Australian leader cabled a message of congratulations to President Nixon. The walk on the moon came near the end of the Monday lunch hour in Sydney, and extended lunch periods were the order of the day. Crowds gathered 10 deep outside television shops. Traffic came nearly to a standstill. Early in the morning, it was quite ordinary to see people carrying radios and television sets into their offices. The viewers were described as subdued. There were no great shouts or cheers. One observer noted it was as if it were a deep personal experience for each one who watched. And the lull in activity in this normally bustling city was said to compare favorably with that on Melbourne Cup Day, the afternoon in November when Australia's most passionately followed horse race is held and the entire nation traditionally comes to a standstill for 3 minutes. The Australians saw a better picture than the rest of the world due to their proximity to the signal, and they saw it a fraction of a second sooner than the rest of the world. The transmission was described as Merit 5, the highest quality, nearly comparable to Portsmouth quality. One Sydney newspaper was on the streets in less than 2.5 hours with a full front page picture of the first step onto the moon. All radio and television stations in the country, 290 broadcasters in all, planned to carry the event. There are a million examples of reaction to the Apollo 11 mission, but one of the most imaginative is this. A Qantas Airlines jet pilot, due to leave Sydney Thursday afternoon for a flight to the United States West Coast, has asked for and received permission to delay his plane's departure by 3 hours. The reason? He hopes to be over the Pacific in the right place at the right time to see the fiery re-entry of Apollo 11's return. Robert Chancellor, Voice of America in Australia.
Now that man has landed on the moon, law cannot be far behind. In fact, recent treaties have already settled some of the problems which may arise from spaceflight. National Broadcasting Company's Carl Stern talked with one of America's specialists in that particular field, Brigadier General Martin Minter.
Brigadier General Martin Minter is the chief legal officer for both the Air Force Aerospace Defense Command and the North American Air Defense Command. He is chairman of the American Bar Association section on aerospace law, perhaps the leading authority on who owns the moon. We don't own the moon. By treaty, we gave up any ownership rights. Has any nation ever been so selfless?
Well, I suppose everyone who voted for the treaty. This was the treaty you referred to, what we call the Outer Space Treaty for short. It was adopted in October 2 years ago, 1967.
And signed by how many nations?
89 nations signed it, and as of today, I believe 50 have ratified.
What if a piece of Russian Sputnik came through our roof? For example, 7 years ago in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, a 14-pound piece of Sputnik bounced onto the main street. Does a citizen have any claim against a government whose space object falls through his roof?
Yes, that's one of the things covered by the treaty, too. First place, the nation which launched it does not lose title to any part of it. And second, if it causes damage, it must recompense any foreign citizen.
The other day, the Soviet Union gave to Frank Borman the data on Luna 15 to make sure there would be no collision between Luna 15 and Apollo 11. Were they obliged to do that?
Yes, I think so. Under the treaty, there's another provision that if any member of the treaty feels that another nation is undertaking an experiment or activity which could be harmful or possibly cause interference, it can request consultation.
What about helping astronauts in trouble? Let's say, for example, a Russian cosmonaut was in trouble on the moon. Would we have to pick him up and give him a ride home in one of our spacecraft?
Well, if we're there and we can do it, yes. In fact, there's another treaty that became effective just last December, and that's a treaty for the return of downed astronauts and space objects. And it expressly provides, if a spaceship should come down in the territory of another state, they must immediately undertake all possible assistance. If it comes down outside of their territory, they must provide whatever assistance they're in a position to do if requested.
I'm sure the astronauts could come back and sell little pieces of the moon for $1 or $10 or $100 a piece. If there is something valuable on the moon, can we mine it if it were commercially feasible to do so, or do we have an obligation to leave things pretty much alone?
Well, that's a question of how you interpret the various provisions of the treaty. There's an Article 2, one that deals with sovereignty, actually, in which we say we have no sovereignty over land masses, that says there'll be no appropriation of land masses. And it's a question of interpretation. In my view, that would not prohibit any exploitation. For example, you certainly could take back samples, because that would be for peaceful exploration. If you did find something that was very valuable, that was over and above the tremendous costs of excavation and transporting back to Earth, which I doubt, but assuming you could, I think you could take it just like you could take fish from the high seas. And high seas are subject to no sovereignty.
What about military use now of the moon? Could we put missiles on the moon? Could Red China put missiles on the moon?
No, there's a very express article in the treaty that very firmly states that there will be no weapons of mass destruction placed on the moon.
Did Red China sign the treaty?
No.
So we don't...
They could, though.
Well, we hope they will in the future. This was started, General Mentor, all started, I guess, with the treaty on the uses of Antarctica, about a dozen years ago?
That's right. That was one of the, that was a very significant precedent. However, this goes beyond that, particularly when you're talking about sovereignty. In the Antarctica Treaty, the governments that became parties to that froze whatever rights they did have. The USSR did not assert any claims of sovereignty, but other states did. And the treaty just froze the claims for a period of 30 years, whereas in this treaty, all nations have that are members have agreed that there will be no sovereignty
forever.
At all,
forever,
at any time.
And guaranteed free access to the moon to
yes.
all nations.
It's open for exploration by all parties to the treaty.
Brigadier General Martin Minter speaking with Carl Stern of the National Broadcasting Company. Senator Edmund Muskie, the Democratic nominee for the vice presidency in the last American election, was one of those who marveled at the success of Apollo 11 and yet questioned whether the United States should not now devote its energies to domestic problems. Senator Muskie talked with National Broadcasting Company correspondent John Chancellor.
Senator, what about priorities? I know you've been worried about the priorities of the space program as opposed to some of the other national priorities we have in this country. Don't you think that tonight, all across the United States, all across the world, there are people who are saying, well, it was worth it?
Well, whether or not it was worth it in the long run, I suppose we won't fully realize until history has written the story. I think it's an achievement that we can take a great deal of satisfaction from, but it can constitute, I think, both a reminder and an inspiration to consider other problems that we need to deal with. I think it's the mood of the Congress, if we were to take a nose count in Congress, that now that we've demonstrated our capacity to do this in space, and maybe we did it at the wrong time, using resources which during this time should have been spent elsewhere, but in any case, we've done this. It is significant. It can be terribly important in the long march of man toward his own improvement. But right now, in the years immediately ahead, there are other things that are more urgent and that we ought to consider what they are and what commitments we need to make. I think one of the inspiring things about this achievement in space is that it's a demonstration of what man is capable of doing once he makes the decision to commit the resources and the will and the energy to do it.
Well, it's interesting that you'd say that, because when John Kennedy announced the Man on the Moon program, he said, we'll do it by the end of the 1970s. A prudent man would have said, we'll do it and let it happen in its own good time. And it occurred to me that we did the Marshall Plan in rebuilding Europe, if I remember my history. We said we'd do that in 5 years. We did it in four. We've done other things with deadlines on them. Do you believe that the American people have the capacity of pulling themselves together and organizing themselves to do something within a deadline? What about a program for the cities or for pollution?
Well, there's another commitment we made over 100 years ago after the Civil War, when we promised to make black men free. They're not yet fully free. Coming down to pollution, another kind of commitment. In 1966, we made a commitment. It's written into the laws of our country that within a four-year period, we would build the waste treatment plants necessary to catch up with the backlog of municipal and domestic wastes in our country. And yet this year, in this fiscal year, when we promised to spend $1 billion of federal money, we budgeted only $214 million. And this Apollo 11 costs us $355 million. So we have not yet, you see, made the commitment in a sense that's meaningful to so many of these problems. It takes a high order of leadership, it takes a high order of citizenship, and it takes an effective communication between the two in order to do this job.
John Gardner, who is sort of a contemporary philosopher, said that
an outstanding man
said that it seemed to him that Apollo 11 was valuable, the whole moon program was valuable, because it demonstrated how well we could organize ourselves as a society, as a people, if we really wanted to, into a tightly disciplined and productive program. We can accomplish anything if we put our minds to it.
Yes, I think he's right, and I think there's another point that perhaps in no other program could a similar demonstration have been made because of our preoccupations in 1960, 61, when this commitment was made. I can't think of another problem toward which we were prepared to make a similar commitment then. And so, having made it and having demonstrated that we can do it, I'd agree with John. Now, we can't pull back and say, well, now that we've taken this first step into space, we can ignore it. That isn't in the nature of the human spirit. And at some level of effort and commitment, we're going to have to continue our exploration of space. I think that perhaps we can do it with unmanned flights to a greater extent than we have. But we've now got to make a violent, I think, shift in our focus in our own country and around the globe to our domestic problems. When I say domestic, I'm speaking not just of United States problems, I'm speaking of problems that face mankind, because we have two, I think, very real and urgent problems confronting us. One is the survivability of man in his environment here on Earth, and secondly, the ability of men of different kinds to live together. These are the two vital and ultimate problems, and if we can't solve them, then whatever may be the possibilities in space will be irrelevant.
Senator Edmund Muskie speaking with National Broadcasting Company correspondent John Chancellor. Many people are expressing their thoughts on the implications of Apollo, of man's venture into the Earth's own permanent satellite. In Nairobi, correspondent Hank Grady talked with Dr. Louis Leakey, a distinguished anthropologist. Here is correspondent Grady's cabled report.
Dr. Louis Leakey, who became famous as the discoverer of the earliest known man, Homo habilis, expressed his belief that technology developed through the U.S. space program and the Apollo 11 flight will benefit mankind in many scientific fields. But he warned that technology could destroy man if he misuses it. The anthropologist said that the moon flight is the logical outgrowth of the capabilities of 2-million-year-old Homo habilis. He explained that if our direct ancestor 2 million years ago had not discovered that he could precisely control his hand grip, and if he did not have an ever-growing computer brain, the flight to the moon never would have been made. Doing things outside his own environment was the start of thinking man, Dr. Leakey said. From then, we progressed regularly to where we are today. At last, able to get out of our own atmosphere and land on something else. The actual value of putting a man on the moon, Dr. Leakey commented, is mostly sentimental. Much like the first man to reach the peak of Mount Everest, but the scientific offshoots of the project, he said, are of great value. All the minute new instruments that have been developed, the wonderful electrical machinery, and the techniques are things which will certainly be used not only for the moon effort, but in all sorts of scientific work. Dr. Leakey said that, at the moment, man is using only a very small part of his potential capabilities. He predicted that the day will come when, for example, salt water will be turned into water usable for agriculture on an economic level. Once we can do that, he said, vast areas of the Earth's surface can produce food for the hungry. He predicted that man will someday be able to develop the ice fields of the Arctic and the Antarctic, also as a source of water. Dr. Leakey said we can go on forever achieving things beyond any dreamt of now. However, he warned that developments such as the atom bomb and germ warfare threaten the future of the world. He said, if we allow such things to get to the point where some wicked person releases them, they won't just wipe out civilized man in the cities and the big countries. Every living creature, even faintly like man, will disappear. And the world will be left only with such things as rats and mice and insects. Dr. Leakey said scientists have an important role to play in fighting destructive forces, especially in building public opinion against them. History has shown again and again, he said, that if enough people are willing to prevent a few people from doing something, the few will not do it.
That cabled report from correspondent Hank Grady in Nairobi, Kenya. This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. The lunar lander Eagle, now on the surface of the moon, some 15 hours and 40 minutes. And the first two men ever to set foot on the moon will start back today after a triumphant landing and two-hour walk on the surface that was watched on television by hundreds of millions of people. The man who took the first step, Apollo 11 mission commander Neil Armstrong, called it a small step for man and a giant leap for mankind. President Nixon thought so, too, and called Commander Armstrong on the moon by radio telephone to congratulate him. Merle Wall, we've heard jokes regarding the command module pilot Collins, that he's the forgotten man. I don't think we can minimize his position, can we?
No, he's essential to the success of the mission. I did detect a few plaintive communications from him when the action shifted to the lunar surface. He acted like maybe he was being forgotten a little bit during this time. But of course, the Mission Control Center at Houston has a large crew, and there's a large number of people paying attention to the command module and his particular job in the operation. The succeeding operation to lift off from the moon and rendezvous, of course, will bring Collins back into the active part of the mission, and his role will be crucial to its success. So he'll be back in the act shortly.
And that is a very vital role when they blast off from the lunar surface later today. What will be his function, briefly?
He, of course, is the target for the rendezvous, and he can play an active role and maybe help spot the limb as it comes up.
Merle, we have a listening reminder. For listeners in Europe, at 11835, switch to 15225 and 17785. Europe and Africa, now listening at 21605, switch to 21670. You're listening to the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 11.